25thFrameMedia.com, a listener-supported network celebrating film and culture worldwide.
Hello, and welcome to Film Baby Film, the podcast for people who love movies or films if you are being pretentious. My name is John Lobinger. I am joined today by Martin Kessler from FlixWise Canada, and it is a very exciting episode. This is going to be our second Alexei Grumman episode. Today we're discussing Krustally Off My Car, which was recently released on Blu-ray here in the U.S. And yeah, it's always a treat to talk to Martin. I've called Martin on the phone. He does not live in the United States. And when I called him, I think the first time I called, he avoided my call because he thought it was like a robocall coming from the U.S. or something. But yeah, he's a heck of a guy to talk movies with. He's very generous with his time and with his excitement about films. And he's just a generous-spirited guy, and always great to chat with him, and particularly great to discuss one of our famous unheralded filmmakers, Alexei Grumman. Movie that we're going to be discussing is, yeah, it's a movie that everybody that loves movies should see. I don't think that Grumman gets enough attention, and I'm hoping that these presentations of Hard to Be a God that came out a few years ago, and now Krustally Off My Car will change a little bit of that. So I'm really excited for you all to listen to this conversation. Like I said, Martin's very passionate. He's particularly passionate about this director and about this movie, so should be a lot of fun. Without any further ado, I always say that, don't I? Without any further ado, Krustally Off My Car with Martin Kessler. This is Film Baby Film. Let's do this. Yeah, so I listened to your discussion on FlixWise Canada with Mtume and Peter.
Peter Rinaldi, yeah.
Peter Rinaldi. They are awesome.
They're great. That was I'm excited that conversation turned out because we all had a little bit different perspectives and things to add, but we're all, you know, vibrating to talk about it.
How is it that there is this... how is it possible today to still have like undiscovered directors? Like, how is it possible that Grumman, like, I think he was always on the I think there was a period of time where he was on the verge in the West to becoming as big as like Bellatar, which granted, Bellatar is not, you know, it's still Bellatar is still not a household name.
Rabbit. Bellatar fans all over the place. We talked a little bit about it when we covered Hard to Be a God on this show. I think, like, he's very highly regarded in Russia. And that's part of the thing is, like, he never quite broke out in the West. He sort of felt, like, on the verge of it, especially in the late 80s. It seemed very possible. And it just... I think part of it is because... he was sort of on the rise in the late 80s after making, after my friend Ivan Lapshin was released, and he didn't really have a follow-up until Krustally Off My Car. He kind of wrote stuff, he taught, he sort of fostered a whole new generation of filmmakers, but I think the fact that there's such a big gap between my friend Ivan Lapshin and Krustally Off My Car, you know, people sort of lost interest in the West or kind of forgot, or, you know, it's not like Terrence Malick where, you know, he's gone for 20 years and that just built anticipation and people were like, you know, salivating for him to come back. I think, you know, there was sort of a loss of momentum. That's my take anyway. I'm sure there's other people who could give you different answers.
Part of it, of course, is that he, was not exactly, he didn't make a ton of movies.
No, you know, and, like, he was never so Russian. Like, I always think like they're more accessible than they seem at first, and like it's really interesting, you know, the way that like M. Tumay or Peter kind of related to it personally, like the fact that it can kind of transcend cultural boundaries in such unexpected ways, I think is really, really interesting. But you know, if I was a distributor, I would be kind of nervous about taking a chance on a film like this. I know, like, it did have a Western distributor in 1998, 1999. I think it was the company that did like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels put that out, and like, you know, a couple other big, maybe they did Ghost in a Shell, or you know, like a couple international releases in America that did well, and then the company went bankrupt right before they released Cristelli in My Car. But I always sort of wonder, like, if it had gotten a big American release, if it would be thought of a little bit differently, or you know, if it would at least have German, you know, more in the spotlight for English speaking film people, cinephiles, film critics, you know, like when I was doing all my research for the article last year, there was something like a little bit, not depressing, but like, you know, 1998 when Cristelli Car came out, I was going through all these film magazines and there was like Sukharov, the new Tarkovsky. And like, he was clearly the kind of Russian filmmaker of the moment. And you know, like I adore Sukharov's films, but it's just like, oh, you know, for whatever reason, Cristelli in My Car didn't quite catch fire, but I think its popularity has been, you know, maybe slowly boiling, waiting to boil over here anyway.
You know, so after I listened to your podcast episode, and I do this sometimes just to sort of gauge, you know, sometimes it feels like I'm the only person podcasting about certain topics. And I just want to like check sometimes to see if that's just my narcissism and solipsism.
I do the same thing. Well, so like, did you say you don't want to like step on other people's toes too much, or like, you know, you sort of feel like, you know, am I just going to say the same things as somebody else? But sorry, I interrupted you.
No. Actually, I mean, it's funny because that's actually the opposite of me. I mean, I've done several podcast episodes where people have done the episode on another show and they just come over to me. They're like, let's talk about it again. So I'm certainly not shy of double dipping or getting, oh gosh, or getting sloppy seconds or whatever. But well, it's more that I just want to check to see like, okay, so what is the appetite? And one way to gauge that is, okay, are there secretly 50 podcast episodes out there about Cristelli of My Car? And I just think I discovered it because I'm a white American male. And so I automatically think I'm Columbus every single thing that I do. So I Googled it. I went on Apple iTunes, and Martin, sure, you are the only person that has podcasted about Alexis German.
That, you know, that somehow doesn't totally surprise me. I mean, it felt a little bit like that for Hard to Be a God, and then like other stuff started coming out. Like, I think it might take a little while because the Blu-ray is still pretty new. A lot of people are just kind of seeing it for the first time right now, it seems like, in the past couple months. So it's still fresh and it's still a lot to digest. You know, like Hard to Be a God, I love the film, obviously, but like I couldn't have done a podcast on it like the first couple months after I'd first seen it. You know, you still sort of take a long time to think through it, and hey, I want to see that again, and you know, even deciding if you like the film or not, I understand for some people it might be a process to kind of come around on it. But I think it's important to have conversations about film like this, so the more I can have, the better. And I'm grateful for you having me on to talk about this, and it seemed like a natural follow-up to the Hard to Be a God episode, especially because when I went through German's films, I kind of went backwards. You know, I started with Hard to Be a God, and then Cristelli in My Car, and then My Friend Ivan Lapshin, and kind of worked my way to the very beginnings. But I don't know if you ever have that experience with filmmakers. You sort of see their progression in reverse. Like, for me, the same way with Bellatar, actually. The first Bellatar film I saw in the theater was the Turin Horse at TIFF when it came out, and that was my introduction to Bellatar. So after that, it was like you actually see his style kind of become more and more subdued, and then it's like static, and then it's in color, and this like cinema verite thing, and it's like, whoa, you watch it de-evolve, actually. But, you know, not that he didn't have great films before, obviously, but it's sort of a weird experience kind of going backwards through somebody's filmography.
But so I think we've spoken. It's funny. So I wrote out some questions I wanted to ask you. You know, I did my homework as a podcast host. And so, but my last question was going to be, you know, why have you written so much about him and yet no one else has? And so what I think we've already talked about why no one else has. So let's kick it off with, you know, tell me a little bit. I know you, obviously, but right. For the people that don't know you and haven't listened to you as much as I have, you know, who are you and why Alexis German?
Right. Who am I? I mean, I'm a filmmaker and I don't know. I would never call myself a film critic. Like, you know, but my film writing, I feel like a lot of it's sort of this, I don't know, like autodidact process that I'm not embarrassed enough by to actually like share with people, because like a part of me would be completely satisfied with writing, I don't know, 40,000 words on Alexis German and not showing anyone, you know, like that was sort of my own process of learning about his films and just feeling sort of compelled and mystified by what I had seen and wanting to understand and wanting to kind of work through and express my feelings about his films. And, you know, that was sort of a big process. And it just so happened that like, hey, I kind of produced these articles along the way that, you know, I was sort of grateful. It did put me in touch with other people, like Peter Rinaldi. You know, we got in touch purely through those articles, or, you know, that's how I got in touch with Daniel Bird, who's produced the Cristelli My Car, Arrow Blu-ray, and, you know, people like that, you know. So I was really kind of grateful that anyone would actually read it. You know, you sort of never know when you put something like that out into the ether. You sort of assume, and like you kind of assume it's just like going into dead space, and then it's weird actually when you get word coming back that, you know, people actually respond to it or read it. You know, or even with podcasting, I don't know if you've had this experience at all, but like I have to find myself being a little bit cautious sometimes when I say, because you sort of realize like, hey, you know, these things that you say actually get out there and they can come back to you or come back to even the people who made the films. Like, on FlixWise early on, we did the Starship Troopers episode, and that was one where you don't really think about it at the time. Like I've had a million conversations about Starship Troopers, and then they got back to us like, hey, at Newmyer, listened to the episode and he forwarded it to Paul Verhoeven, and then he came on the show to talk about Metropolis, and you know, that was all good. But like you immediately feel this sort of sinking feeling of like, oh no, did I say a million stupid things? And but you know, so I don't always feel like what I'm putting out is polished in the way that I think like film criticism should be, really. Like I'm not a academic, I'm not like a trained film critic or anything like that, but you know, it's just sort of for me kind of wanting to learn more about the films that inspire me, move me, fascinate me. And that's kind of why I fixated on Alexis German. Like he's I don't know, like not just that he's a great filmmaker who wasn't really talked about, but like, you know, something about his filmmaking spoke very strongly to me. And, you know, I didn't want to make it too personal, my writing. I feel like, yeah, there's obviously personal stuff in there because I can't really separate myself completely from myself. But, you know, it's meaningful to me. And I tried to sort of work through that and better understand what's going on in these films. And in some cases, understand that it's okay to not completely understand what's going on in these films. I don't know if you've had any of that sensation coming through. Like, you know, there's certain filmmakers, you know, they feel like, okay, this is my person, this is my guy, or this is my gal, you know, like for you, maybe it might be Berkman, or, you know, for other people, it might be Tarkovsky, or, you know, like you have those filmmakers that really mean something a little bit extra to you, aside from, oh, this is a brilliant, genius filmmaker. And for me, Alexei Garman, he's one of those, I think.
So one clarifying point, and then we'll follow up on the thrust of what you said. The clarifying point is, so pinksmoke.com is where you wrote a series of five. So I had you on to talk about Hard to Be a God, and that was my first, Alexei Garman. Sadly, this is only my second, so I really want to stress that I am not a Garman expert, although my love for him is really strong for somebody I've only seen two of his films.
Yes.
So you wrote, but after you came on the episode, or around the same time that you came on to discuss Hard to Be a God, and we gushed over that movie.
I think I even said on your show, like, I don't even think Hard to Be a God's his best film. Like, there's so much more.
Yeah,
to
you're an see. Ivan Lapshin. You're a My Friend Ivan Lapshin guy.
Yeah, which I don't think, like, that's, you know, once you do get into people who have seen all his films and kind of talk about them, like, I think that's probably the standard answer.
That's, you know, my, like, sense. That's my sense from what I've read, which is great because, like you said, I'm going backwards. So I know that I have this great masterwork, and there's a part of me that's like, how could they get any better than these two?
I mean, okay, Citizen Kane's here, and like up here is My Friend Ivan Lapshin. I'm sure I just hyped it up too much for you, but I really think you're going to love this film. You know, I know Peter Rinaldi said like it's his favorite Alexei Garman film, maybe his favorite film, period. It's just, once you see it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And it's kind of the flip side to Khrushchev in My Car. Although Khrushchev in My Car is also kind of the flip side to Hard to Be a God. So, like, I don't know. So few films, they all kind of feel like in conversation with each other. And they're all kind of connected, obviously. But I don't think you can spoil it. And I'm not really, like, a spoiler guy. But I'm like, oh, I can't wait for you to see it and just hear what your thoughts are. I'm excited to hear your thoughts about Khrushchev in My Car because, you know, it's interesting to me what somebody's new perspective is on it and how they're going to react to it.
So, spoiler alert, I freaking love it. I mean, there's a part of me that, like, Garman makes me feel like just want to talk in hyperboles. And I haven't really felt that way. You know, I don't know if it's that I'm oversaturated with movies or if it's like I'm refocusing. You know, I'm starting to, I got a new girlfriend and I like moved to a new city and I'm like doing all these things. And so my life is being filled up with other stuff. Like maybe I was wondering like, oh, am I burnt out on movies for the moment?
Right.
But then I pop in this movie and it's like, oh, okay. It still works on me. Like, you know, it still works on me. This is the good stuff. This is the raw, uncut Black Tar. You know, this is like, okay, all right. There's still a little bit of juice, you know, left to squeeze out of this thing.
Right.
And I'm a huge fan, but I want to get back to the point that you said that was like, you, to some extent, you have to just accept that you're not going to be able to rationalize or completely understand every aspect of the movie. How many times have you seen Khrushchev, My Car?
Oh, I've lost track at this point. Like when I was writing about it, I would just watch it kind of through over and over again. And like there, you sort of run into certain limitations, but it really is one of those films that I think you can pick up something new every time. And like since I've written that, you know, the new Blu-ray is out, there's new special features and interviews I never saw before, there's a new translation which is much better, there's like the fact that you can see in the new restoration like all the details in the background that you couldn't before on the little, you know, bootleg Russian DVD, like it does sort of enhance the film. You know, so it's almost like I wish I, you know, would go back and I don't know, there's no point to it, but I kind of want to just like throw out everything I've written and rewrite it all from scratch. But, you know, that was sort of my feeling on it. I don't know, like realistically, maybe a dozen times, something like that. For me, it's not a hard watch. There's stuff in it that's hard to watch, but, you know, I don't find it. Like, strangely, I don't find it an exhausting film or, like, a...
No,
I don't know. Like, it's actually, like, energizing and it's actually sort of... It's difficult to say. I mean, like, I'll feel differently about it different times I watch it, but, you know, just
it's this a world. Last time, it's right, a world, like, you can. It's a world you can easily live in and stop, yes, by. Yeah. And so the other movie that I thought, and we're gonna hold off on making, because I want to just like do like an entire portion of this episode where we just talk about the other creators and the other movies, right, that the other literature, like, I want to talk about all the references, but let's just hold that for like its own section.
Sure.
But the one thing I want to say now, the only other movie that I know that's like this in terms of I can put it on in the background and I can just put it on one right after the other and just sort of live with it for a little while is The Long Goodbye.
Okay.
That's movie where I could rock The Long Goodbye every day for a week.
I feel that. I know where you're coming from exactly. Like, it's hard to kind of say exactly where, but there is something sort of Robert Altman-y about Alexis Guermain's films, or at least, like, there's something similar about both filmmakers that really appeals to me when it works. Like, I mean, Altman, you know, he had brilliant films. He also made, like, say, like, interesting failures, maybe. You know, he's got one of those frustrating filmographies. It's not like Guermain where, you know, there's just that handful of films and they're all kind of spectacular. But, like, Robert Altman, like, his greatest films, like Three Women or The Long Goodbye, like, they all kind of feel that sort of ambling and mysterious and also potent, you know. And again, like, the dialogue, I've mentioned a little bit on the FlixWise podcast, but just the similarity in having people talk over each other, and, you know, it feels like just a different approach to life that they're putting on screen.
So you say you've seen this film a dozen times, so you may literally have seen this movie more than anybody else alive right now. You say you've seen it like a dozen times.
Yeah, that's actually probably a conservative estimate.
But, what percentage of the information contained in this film do you think has been imparted to you? Like, what percentage of this movie do you think you, like, get?
I feel like there's no way to answer this without sounding like a blowhard. It helps that I did, like, a lot of periphery reading about it and trying to kind of fill in some of the gaps on my own, but it's almost besides the point. Like, I don't know. I might not get everything on an intellectual level. Like, I might not get everything, every intention, but I feel like that's not really how you're supposed to watch the film anyway. Like, I think it's working on a more emotional, rhythmic level, and I feel like in that way I completely get it. Like, it hits me so hard. It's really amazing. And the fact that I might not get every nuance to the you know, the historical connections or literary connections that went into it, into all those details, like, it's sort of, I'm okay with that. I feel like, you know, that's how that film works. You know, these details, they just sort of overwhelm you, actually, and I think that's part of the experience.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like if Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton got together, they made a movie, and they decided that they were going to do nothing but, like, just as many pratfalls and slapstick as they could possibly do. There's a lot of slapstick
in this, yeah. Like,
and I do mean, it for 2.5 hours. But meanwhile, they're also reading James Joyce Ulysses, like, during that. Maybe. There is a part of it where it's like, yeah, okay, so you don't get the Ulysses, but it's two masters doing slapstick. Like, you know, interesting camera movements, like, joke after joke, visual. There's a joke going on in the foreground, and there's a joke going on in the focal center, and then a joke going on in the background.
There's things that, you know, you sort of forget, or, like, you kind of, you know, they go to the back of your mind as you're watching something serious, and then, like, you watch it again, and, no, it's hilarious that there's a pig in the side jar of the motorbike. Like, it's just so funny. You know, all these strange details, or, yeah, like, that slapstick element to it, the lead actor, like, he's so good at that. There's, like, this incredible physical quality to it. I mean, like, the Joyce comparison, I don't know. Like, I still sort of mentioned it before, but I'm not sure that might be right. Like, it's too visceral for all that. And, like, you know, Yuri Cirillo, like, his performance in it, I like that, you know... He's obviously, like, a brilliant character. Like, he's a brain surgeon, after all. But he's, you know, like, not really this kind of intellectual type. Like, there's... blue collar's not the right word for it, but that's the first one that comes to mind. Like, he's very physical, and he's very, you know, like, his gymnastic acts. Like, every dimension to his performance has this real, strong, tangible element to it that I think is important to the... character. And you know, everything he does, like, a lot of it's through actions, and he's always, like, doing something. And you know, it can say something about his character. Like, one moment I really love is when he's brought to look at Stalin, who's dying in the film, and he just, like, slips himself a shot of the morphine. Like, I don't know if you noticed that, but
I did notice that.
In the stomach, and, like, you know, that to me, that says something about his character. Like, you know, nobody's looking, he's just gonna shoot up with this morphine because of what happened to him earlier. But I don't know, like, his physical presence and his performance, I'm always kind of astonished by it watching this film. I know, like, the original actor that German had in mind was Dovlatov, who wasn't an actor. He was a journalist and writer. And Alexei German's son, Alexei German Jr., just did, like, a biopic about Dovlatov. I don't know if you've seen. It's, like, on Netflix, and it's actually pretty easy to get a hold of compared to some of his other films. It just came out last year. Did you see any of that or hear anything?
I did not. No, I heard it. I read about it in your article.
Okay, like, Dovlatov, he left for America, and he died pretty young. Like, he was, I think, like, basically the same generation as Alexei German. And when I watched the biopic, the son's film, like, you know, in some ways I thought it was a little bit about his father, like, about Alexei German, just in that they're from the same generation, and they're both these kind of, like... big, smart guys sort of who are outside the system and trying to kind of find their own creative path. Like, you know, just in that way, it was like dual Dovlatov biopic while being like a thinly veiled Alexei German kind of, not biopic, but sort of you could feel there was something about him that was kind of my take on it. And like, if you ever see a picture of Dovlatov, he was like this huge guy with a mustache, but you know, he's also like a brilliant writer, and just that kind of combination of this sort of big physical presence and the cerebral aspect to it, I think that kind of got built into the character. So, you know, when Dovlatov died, it sort of made sense that you would find somebody like Yuri Cirillo, who has that, I don't know, there's like this weird blending of intelligence with the kind of, you know, Charlie Chaplin-y physicality.
Oh, absolutely. No, he's amazing, and it's interesting because I don't know that much about Russian film, so there was a part of me that just assumed that this guy must have made dozens of films before he was cast in this. And then and then you hear the story, and it's like, no, he just got into a fight one night, and I think he calls himself like a gypsy blacksmith.
Yeah, he's ethnically gypsy, and I mean, you know, in the film, the character is Jewish, but like I sort of wondered if, I don't know, I didn't seem to speak on it, but I just kind of wondered if, you know, this idea of being like a bit of a ethnic minority in Russia might have also sort of informed his performance. Like, you know, even today, like Gypsy or Roma, depending on who you ask, I know people have different strong opinions what they should say, but like it's... there's still a lot of prejudice today. And there's also still a lot of anti-Semitism today in Europe, believe it or not. You know,
so oh, no, like, I believe it. I believe it. Yeah. I've read enough about France and Le Pen to know.
You know, so like, I'd wondered if, you know, maybe his background also kind of informed the performance, and, you know, being the sort of somebody who prejudice is sort of hurled against the character, but, you know, not in these sort of obvious ways. Like I mean, Russia, it's a very long history of anti-Semitism. You know, you think of, like, even before Soviet Union, the pogroms and that sort of thing. And then, you know, of course, Lenin was anti-Semite, and Stalin, of course, was anti-Semite. But it never really, like, resembled the, you know, the Hitler, Nazi, German kind of rhetoric around it. Like, in some ways, it's sort of more accepting, but to a point. And, you know, then the lethality kind of only comes out when it's serving some sort of political goal, you know, if it's to eliminate some political enemy. But, you know, it looks a little bit different than, like, the Nazi German anti-Semitism. I think it's in some ways a bit more... and also, like, it makes it trickier to talk about in films. But, you know, Alexei Garman himself had, you know, Jewish background and sort of complicated relationship with his own, you know, Jewish identity, and this idea that, like, growing up as a kid in Russia in the 50s, in the Soviet Union in the 50s, it's like, oh, well, you're either a Jew or you're Russian, you can't be both. And it's like sort of arbitrary how other people would decide which you were. But you know,
he basically said he was one of the few that was less of an issue for him, because mm-hmm. his dad was the successful writer, and while his mother was, I guess his mother must have been half Jewish, because he said he was 25% Jewish, mm-hmm. whatever. I mean, it sounded like he was saying he sort of escaped some of that, but he was also painfully aware, because his father knew, because his father was a successful writer. One, anybody that's a successful artist under Stalin just knew that they were, like, one wrong turn.
Right.
One bad mood away from ending up in a gulag or having your, you know, having your wife having to pay a visit to Beria. Like,
sure. Exactly.
And so he is of two worlds, Alexei Garman, because he never actually suffered that downfall, but his family was painfully aware that this was a possibility at any moment, and I'm sure that has its own special influence on a person. So let me, I want to come back to this, because the setting of the historical background of this film is so fascinating. And the Jonathan Brent, it's not even an interview. It's just Jonathan Brent talking for 45 minutes, and it's captivating. Him talking about the doctor's plot and basically picking it apart and saying, you know, it's not exactly what you think it is. Like, you want to just assume because Stalin was anti-Semitic, and because this was a plot against the Jews, that it was just this, you know, just this plot that was just for anti-Semitism's sake. And he's like, that is so not what this is. And that was, he started off with that. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So there's so much to talk about that. But I do want to push you to what I think is its own circus feat. I know that Klinsky does lots of, you know, acrobatic and circus strongman-like performances, almost like La Strada.
Right.
But I want to see if I can get you, like, how quickly you can summarize the plot of this movie. Like, how many sentences you can get it in under. Because the plot isn't really the point. We can fill in from there. Right. But I think I more just want to see, like, how good, like, how terse you can get this.
Okay, so my summary of the plot. A Jewish doctor in the upper echelons of Soviet society falls out of favor and faces oblivion, only to be pulled back to the center of it all, meeting Stalin on his deathbed. And after that, finds himself out of place in the world. How's that?
Oh, that was like a poem.
This film is like a poem.
That's amazing, man. That's amazing. So how does a movie that comes down to that fill up 2.5 hours and about 3 parallel universes?
Well, I mean, you see it all. Like, you really see life at the time. You get a feel for it. Like, I think that's the kind of important part, and that's where the bulk of it is filled out. It's, you know, that feel for life and just exploring every kind of facet of it. And that, you know, it's got the almost carousel like camera going up and down and around, and you just feel like you get to experience it all. You see it all in a very immersive way. I think that's kind of the thing that I keep coming back to with the film and find so compelling, is just how it plunges you right into the middle of this. And I don't know, there's not really context for it, but, like, you know, for somebody caught up in that situation, there's no context for them either. Like, it's right. Just this thing that happens, and any kind of explanation will come after the fact. And for me, that, you know, that was almost like an asset going into the film blind the first time, is it was all sort of happening, you know, in a way to me for the first time, and sort of experiencing the horror of it and the humor of it and the irony of it and coming full circle, and then later coming back and trying to fill in the gaps and fill in the pieces. And, you know, even more recent viewings, like watching it, and, you know, when you have all the NKVD piling out of that truck that looks like a logging truck, it's disguised to hide all these guys, and they come out almost like the clowns out of a clown car at a circus.
Well, but don't they look like I thought that they were, like, dressed up as skiers, like the people that were, like, coming to get Klensky. I was like, coming
by, but, like, like, are those agents too, like the guys on skis?
Oh, of course,
but, like,
they were.
Earlier,
they were
in the film, there's a logging truck going by, and, like, I'm like, is that the same logging truck? And, like, you start to wonder, like, oh, is that, like, are there other connections here that I'm not even picking up on? And you keep trying to pull at that string more and more and see if how much you can unravel.
Because, of course, that is the sort of state of paranoia. That is the sort of bizarre terror mm-hmm. that happens when something like this happens, right? Because it's not like these people did something, and so they're sitting there going, oh my gosh, you know, we're found out. We have some big assassination plot against Stalin, right. And we've been found out, and so we're living in terror. It's like you're just sitting there one day, and all of a sudden your double shows up, and you're like, huh, that's weird that my doppelganger is in my hospital. I'm thinking something bad is about to happen, but yep. I can't really put my finger on it, you know? And it's sort of because I don't know if it was you that said it, or if it was one of your article, or if it was something I read or watched from the new Blu-ray release. But the idea being that in one of Stalin's purges or whatever, so much of it was nonsensical and had nothing yes. to do with you, that when the thing broke down on you like a wave, it was like you didn't find out about what was going on until someone explains it to you, like, 5 years yeah. later or 10 years later, if you survive.
Like, the whole thing with the double, it's such a weird, it feels like some, like, literary touch, like some invention to, you know, have a symbolic meaning, but it's like, oh no, that really happened. It really was this absurd where, you know, you'd be shipped off, and, like, the person on trial, on the show trial, is just a lookalike, you know, that would really happen. It's so strange, but at the same time, it's coming from life, actually. And that's, you know, for a lot of these details in the film, it's like, oh, that's so bizarre, that's so weird what I'm seeing. And oh, like, there's a historical precedent for that. It's coming from research. It's not just invented. And to, you know, just imagine that was life at that time for people. It's sort of astounding, I think.
But I also like the fact that this, in for most of it, maybe all of it, I mean, maybe there's one scene, and not actually the scene in the champagne truck. I think it's the scene mm-hmm. after the champagne truck that actually is played for dramatic effect. But for most of it, like, all this stuff is happening. There's this anxious terror going on. But you don't even get that sort of Kafka-esque, like, the feeling of being manipulated, or that, like, slight feeling of unease. Or at least I didn't. For me, it was sort of this weird, absurdist celebration of life. Not in the life is beautiful kind of way, but in the way that's like, that's like, it's like, hey, look, life is absolutely ridiculous. I like the fact that the furrier the guy who we see at the beginning, who he isn't even a part of the Doctor's plot. Like, he's
just like, he has the bad luck of like looking in the wrong car, basically. Like, that's all he does.
He is collateral damage on a plot that is collateral damage. And
like, the thing, like, there was no Doctor's plot. Like, I think that's what some people don't realize about the Doctor's plot when you first hear it, is like, it didn't exist. It wasn't a thing. It was an invention. And it's like, you know, these layers of kind of falseness compound and just makes this, you know, bizarre life where everyone's kind of living a lie and being arrested for crimes which are a lie. And like, I don't know. I mean, there's definitely this idea that life under Stalinism, like, anyone could have potentially been guilty of a crime. Like, the more ways in which you make people break the law, like, the more ways you can kind of control people and have power over your society. Like, I think that's part of it too. And going back to the Jewish thing for a minute, like, it's so interesting to me, the relationship between the father and the son in the film, because, you know, what you find out based on the Doctor's plot, like, Kelensky's Jewish, and, you know, the name you can probably already guess, but, like, you know, the stuff the son's repeating in the schoolyard, and it's like he has no idea, like, you know, it's this sort of disassociation, you know, like you said about the German being a little bit insulated from all this awfulness and kind of being in a privileged position. You know, in that way, I think the film takes on this sort of what if quality, and it's obviously coming from a very personal place, but like understanding, like, how, you know, even if it didn't fall apart, like, you know, your life was always on this knife edge growing up in that.
Yeah, and so the son is fascinating to me, mm-hmm. Because when you're introduced to him at the beginning, and knowing what we know about, like, the history of Russian cinema, like Ivan's childhood and Mirror, and you just sort of assume that when he spits at that mirror, like, to some extent, this is going to be a movie about little Alexei, and it just isn't. Like, no. That's what it's. He does have his part to play, and it's interesting, but it's like German wants to give us different layers and different perspectives before we get into, you know, the story that he's really going to tell. We get introduced to all these characters, and then we see Kelensky.
Yes,
but the son is really interesting because when you hear the backstory, this is like a what if tale. And then there's also some people, you know, one of those interpretations, whenever you see a movie that has like absurdist or farcical aspects to it, to what extent some of the ending of the movie is just the way that somebody would imagine a father who got disappeared. Like, what would have happened to him? Whereas really, you know, maybe the dad actually did just, once Stalin passed, they're like, all right, you didn't do the job. Now we're going to do the job on you. So
yes,
the son, how much importance the son actually, but like, is he at all responsible for the downfall of his father in the movie? Or is he just on the verge of taking, you know,
I mean, I think
taking
on
his
the
dad
verge
down,
is right. Like, he, you know, when the father comes back after they've been relocated to that, you know, like, crappy housing unit that they're stuck in near the end, like, he tries to report on his own father. And, you know, I think, like, for we talked a little bit about it on the Heart to Be a God episode, this idea of German kind of exposing these dark aspects of our nature and trying to understand that there's something potentially fallible in all of us to, you know, do something horrible. And I think, like, you know, even though, you know, it doesn't exactly work out the way you might think, like, the son does try to report on his father, and you understand, like, kids did report on their parents, and it happened, and to kind of, you know, see that in himself, in a way, you know, with this character, like, I don't know, like, I always kind of keep coming back to that relationship between the father and the son, and, like, all the ways that the son is weak and the father is strong, and all the ways that the father is not necessarily noble, but, you know, like, it's one of those things that it's sort of hard to untangle, but you really do feel like in a way that the Son represents something within the Father and, you know, something that could be in all of us. So I think, like, in that way, he's key to the film, even though he's not really significant to the plot per se. And, you know, the way he frames the story is very important because, you know, no matter what, you're going to be looking at Klinsky as the father figure. Like, that's how you're introduced to him. And that's kind of what identity he takes on. And you're seeing him through the son's eyes in a way, like you sort of mentioned, some of it could even be an imagining of a son for his father.
The, gosh, there's so many.
I know.
There's so many scenes in particular that I want to discuss. I think the first one that hit me was just how ridiculous and grotesque the stroll when Klinsky is still general, when he is still, mm-hmm. you know, the boss, and he strolls through the hospital. And by the way, none of these people look like their brain surgeries have been particularly successful. And if he's the brain surgeon, it's like, is he really? Like, what? Those people, that they don't look like they had their wounds closed. Like, but no, so, okay, so you have this amazing, and he's, like, playing an instrument, and it appears that these doctors are clowning, while at the same time there's, oh, gosh, that one of the doctors is going to be sent away to a gulag, like, is going to be fired or sent away to a gulag because he's Jewish, and, you know, and then... Oh man, the Kafka-esque, like Orson Welles' The Trial, like that sexual weirdness of like when his subordinate forget the blowjob, when the subordinate licks the button on his coat, and you're like, yes. What the hell?
I know, it's like licking a nipple, like it's very sort of
the whole thing is just one long stretch of just. Like, it's like at one point they're clowning, like, I don't even know, Lestrada or Sawdust and Tinsel. And then the next minute they're walking through Tittacat Follies. But no, they're clowning while they're walking through Tittacat Follies. And then they end up in, like, you know, Orson Welles' The Trial, where the girl seduces Joseph K., yeah. And it's like what is this? And I've seen Hard to Be a God, so I've seen that weird stroll that happens. I mean, it happens like five times in Hard to Be a God, but in this one, I'm like, I was not prepared for this.
So, I mean, what was funny to me about going from Hard to Be a God to Christelli in My Car, it's like the ways in which Hard to Be a God is a metaphor for Russian life and Russian history. Become sort of immediately apparent when you realize, like, oh, like all that medieval weirdness, that's actually like recent Russian history. Like, it felt like that maybe, or at least felt like that to Alexei German and how he interprets it. But I know that sequence is so wild, and like the sexual politics, the way, you know, it sort of displays power, and then later, of course, that's inverted when Klinsky's raped in the back of the truck. But it's you know, you sort of feel it commenting on, you know, the relationship between power and sexuality. And in that way, you could say, like, you know, there's maybe even something a little bit Pasolini like about it, although it's the style's not really rigid at all like you'd expect from Pasolini, but it has that kind of,
well, certainly German and Pasolini certainly care a lot about shit. So there's definitely that going on.
that is also true.
I mean, clearly this is no Salo, but, you know, some of it, I realize that basically all of Pasolini's movie, I mean, maybe this is more
is kind of like Salo, except instead of like a little republic, it's a, you know, the biggest nation on earth, the Soviet Union, you know, and instead of four libertines, you just have one dying Stalin at the end and maybe Beria off in the corner.
Yeah, and you know, he dies.
It's actually more like Salo than I thought.
Well, no, and then I saw, what is it? Not Acatone, but Mama Roma, where the kid, I mean, that was a particularly Italian thing because they all did the castor oil tortures. And so, like, the idea of dying from diarrhea was actually, that was real for the Italians. That was one of the tortures that the fascists like to use. And of course, Armored Core gets, when people talk about other movies that they want to compare to Krustalia Off My Car, Armored Core comes up, that mixture of like absurdism, but also a celebration of life, children, and just, you know, horrendous totalitarianism. That whole bundle, like the two are definitely related that way. But again, poop. It's just, there's a lot of, this movie doesn't have as much shit as Hard to Be a God. That's for sure. Plenty of snot. There's definitely a lot of body humor, particularly.
There's some farting.
Stalin dies.
Bodily functions. Yeah.
Stalin dies while like soiling himself. Again, very definitely reminds me of the ending of Mama Rome. Oh, wow. So that's a spoiler.
That's okay. I have a feeling, like, if you've seen the, that's the if least you're listening spoiler to this podcast, ever. You probably.
Right. But it's also kind of the least spoiler ever. It's like, what? Somebody's going to die from diarrhea. My God. But I mean, the truth is that the shockingness. This is not and we said this about Hard to Be a God. This is not Hostel. This clearly is not. And this is, Hard to Be a God is a much more, plays a lot more with those baser aspects of life with the, I almost want to say sadistic, not in the way that we say the word sadistic, but how Marquis de Sade in the great, a movie that I really dig, Quills, said basically, there's many beautiful things that humanity does, but the fact of the matter is, the awful things also bind us together and make us who we are. Like, this movie really trades in the nastiness of being a mind that is attached to a corporeal body, you know? Yes. There's just no escaping the stuff that's going to happen to us.
There's no soul inside the human body when it dies in German's films. It's just gases. Like, that's all that's inside
it's
of us.
And gases. That's okay. It's like, just that's very it's just a flap on the side of the brain. On the side but of you your feel head.
Like, there's a real love for that and a love for these people. Like, there's one shot where, I think it's when Klinsky tries to get away to the village and it's sort of panning through people. There's like a woman asking, like, have you seen my kid? And it just goes across this one guy's face and he's like, I like being Russian. And I sort of, I feel for that. Like, there's an actual love of Russia. And, even though it's sort of dealing with all these dark things, there's such a love for these people, and I don't know, I think that comes through somehow. It's not, not spiteful, not kind of condescending, like, it likes being down in the dirt, this film, I think.
Oh, absolutely. It's not, not to reference our old episode again, but there was an aspect that, so I told you that the Boston Noirs were big on, like, always making sure that every bar had at least one guy with a hair lip in the bar to really show you, like, this was a gritty bar. And in fact, I think one Ben Affleck movie had two guys with a hair lip in one bar, and you're like, oh, wow, this is a very gritty bar. Like, to some extent, there is a little bit of that play here with a lot of the, but at the same time, in this movie, it isn't just the guy in the bar with, some disfigurement. It's like these people are actors. They are as much a part of this world as Klinsky or anybody else. Like the people, the people that are in the Soviet champagne truck. I mean, I don't know that any of those people are trained classical actors. But gosh, like, they really deliver the goods, like, when they have to. And many of the extras in many of the other scenes, the children in this movie, absolutely, they are just as much a part of the slapstick genius of anything.
I like when, I think when he's out in the country, like, when the kids start attacking Klinsky, this gang of kids, it just makes me think of, like, Gulliver's Travels, like, how big he is and how they're all kind of, like, teaming up on him and trying to bring him down. And he's just swinging the shovel at them, like, German's always great at directing, either non-actors or kind of mixing professional actors with non-trained actors. And I think casting for effect sometimes, like, you have these people where, like, just their face kind of says something or expresses something, and it's, you know, not necessarily the kind of typical performative kind of acting, although you do get some of that, obviously.
So the fight scene is amazing. It's also amazing that the thing that crushes this guy's dreams is a bunch of kids doing a prank. This isn't like the secret, you know, the Stalin's amazing 10 million network of informers have ensnared this guy in a trap. No, it's a bunch of random kids that decide to beat up this guy for no reason. That is what is his downfall.
And when they come to take him away, they make such a big deal out of it, like photographing him like he's some big capture. Oh,
I love that. Yeah. I love that. And then I love the little extra touch that... So first of all, I think it was Mtume or maybe it was Peter that was asking about the nose thing. There's a nose thing that also happens in Hard to Be a God where they like... Klinsky and the guy in the bar grab each other's nose and they just sit there with each other's noses. They don't know each other. There's no reason to do this. It's not even homoerotic. It's just weird and aggressive. And if somebody grabbed my nose that way that I didn't know, even as a grown-ass man who, like, you know, should not get into physical altercations because I'm liable to get injured... I would not take this. And it just happens in the bar and it happens elsewhere. It's like, what is going on here? This is a form of clowning that I'm just not, and slapstick that I'm just not familiar with. But then it's amazing. Cause then afterwards when Klinsky gets busted after the kids beat him up with, and beat him down with sticks, he goes up to the guy that he had gotten into the fight with in the bar and then says, tell everybody that I got caught. Like, basically implicating this random dude in whatever trap he's been ensnared in. He's now going to entrap this other guy.
This revenge by association. Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great scene, too. The sexual assault that happens on Klinsky in the Soviet champagne truck. And I know that that's like a real, that like sort of little piece of information that came from what, the Gulag Archipelago?
The Solzhenitsyn.
So that's another one of those real pieces. I'll tell you, that's the only time that this movie really goes into the Hard to Be a God territory for me. The rest of it, it's like, yeah, it's the rest of it. I'm mostly playing for like, I want to live in this environment for a little while. I want to like hear what the people have to say, see what they're going to do. But that was the moment where it was like, oh gosh, yeah, I guess I am in an Alexei German film right now.
Well, they're so ghoulish in the truck, like the, and the way they get like turned on with each other, like sticking their fingers in the mouths, like it almost made me think of like Clyde Barker's Hellraiser, where the monsters have this kind of sadomasochistic dimension to them. And you know, that there's something about like there's a lot of things going on in that scene that are gross, but for whatever reason the fingers going in the mouth between like two of the guys watching is the one that grosses me out most.
what was the movie towards the end of John Candy's career where it was John Candy, Dan Aykroyd, Chevy Chase,
Dan Aykroyd, and
Dan Aykroyd plays like seven different characters under heavy makeup. Oh, and they're all like greasy. Nothing but trouble. Absolutely.
I'm gonna Google this really quick.
All the people in that truck look
Where Dan Aykroyd's got the makeup all over his face.
And the, like, the two little twin brothers that are all greasy and want to, like, take down Demi Moore. Yeah. Like, they all, all the people in that truck seem, like, slightly less exaggerated versions.
Like, there's that little bit heightened quality, like, you get in Hard to Be a God, where it's, like... they're a little bit uglier than you might expect in real life, and the camera feels like a little bit closer, and you just sort of get this heightened quality to it, which, you know, in that particular scene is incredibly uncomfortable.
So do you think that the ending is real, particularly, like, and I know that the answer is who cares, I mean, when I say that in most films, like, oh, who cares what the actual, right. like, I don't actually mean that. I actually do want to know. But yeah. this is one of those movies where, no, I don't care what the interpretation of it is. This world is so complete that I just like totally embrace it. But I still want to know what your opinion is. Do you think that, that the general actually lives, gets away and is like, you know, living like a hobo king on this train?
I think he does. Like, that's my impression anyway. I like your possible interpretation too, but like, to me, I don't know, Klinsky, like, he seems like a survivor, and just thinking about like a sort of 20th century perspective of Jewish history, it's like, I don't know, a part of me feels like, yeah, he can survive all of this. Like, there's, you know, as awful as anything that comes down at him can be, it's like he'll, you know, disappear into the mist and you know, keep on being alive, even if he's sort of damaged and hurt along the way. It's, you know, he seems doomed to kind of wander the earth no matter what after his encounter with these people who, it, like, you know, that scene with Beria, you know, Beria is going to be dead very soon after.
I do, and because I saw Death of Stalin.
Sure.
Right. I saw the Iannucci movie.
Right. But, you know, it sort of feels like, right, that all these people who are kind of tormenting and pulling the strings, like, they're going to be dead themselves, and Klinsky of all these people will actually survive this. And I don't know, the stoker who kind of returns at the end going, the liberty! You know, it just seems like too perfect a kind of ending to think of it as just being, you know, a dream. I mean, in a way, the whole thing is kind of a dream. So, you know, like, the thing that always sort of bothers me about these, like, fan theories or interpretations of, like, oh, is it all real, is you can kind of do it for anything, because in a way, like, every movie is sort of a dream or sort of an imagining. So it's like, yeah, Star Wars is all a dream in George Lucas's head, you know, like, you can kind of do that. But like, in this particular case, I think just the fact that it is coming from that son's perspective and sort of his thinking of, you know, where his father might have ended up, the way he kind of disappears, you know, that the epilogue could be a sort of imagining of where he would like his father to be. So, you know, I think that's interesting, actually. And I don't, like, structurally, I find that really interesting too. Like, I've been working on this historical fiction thing for about a year, kind of privately, a little bit secretly, that I was sort of trying to draw some inspiration from Christy Elliott Makar and my friend Ivan Lapshin for. But I'd heard somewhere that Paul Robeson and Stalin's kids went to school together.
Which, no way. You know,
it's like one of those factoids that like sticks in your head like a thorn.
How is that even possible?
Well, like, you know, I was reading a lot about Harlem Renaissance and sort of figures like Paul Robeson. What I'm trying to write, I don't know, like, it's sort of at a stage where like it could be a screenplay or could be a novella. Like, I'm kind of, it's more like a really detailed outline right now. But, you know, it sort of interested me, these, you know, intellectual Renaissance men, Black Americans who kind of fell in love with the Soviet Union, like Paul Robeson. I mean, if you ever want to see something neat, just YouTube like Paul Robeson Soviet National Anthem singing, and, you know, learning Russian, and, you know, a lot of people moved over there, and then, you know, that would have been maybe 1930s or around that time, and then by this period, the Khrushchev, my car, a lot of people were dead or disillusioned, you know, they had like a very different feeling. So like, just that kind of double disillusionment of being caught between the United States and the Soviet Union at that time period, I found really compelling. So I tried to write a kind of piece that, you know, it's not like about Paul Robeson, you know, and it's sort of a, you know, a little bit invention, a little bit based on some other real figures, but you know, this idea of trying to structure this fictional person's life story and, you know, doing it from the perspective of his daughter, who would be an adult, kind of looking back and narrating and all that stuff. I was a little bit looking at Christelle in my car to kind of help just in terms of, you know, the basic outline. Like, I wouldn't try to copy it exactly, of course, but...
But how can you, not?
That was definitely an inspiration. I know, like...
No, how can you, this makes me so happy that you're saying this. This is actually... So once I realized that we started off with my final question, I added... I was typing at the beginning of the episode, and people can probably hear it. I typed, do you find yourself wanting to make a movie like Alexis Guillermin? And of course, I heard him to me say, like, yo, I gave this movie to my, you know, I gave one of Guillermin's movies to one of my students. I hope he watched it. Like, this, whenever I watch Hard to Be a God or this, like, immediately there's a part of me that's like, and I there's a part of me that's like, everybody in film school has to see some Alexis Guillermin. Yeah. This is this, you know, in the choose your own adventure branches of the way that film history has worked. There's this one branch that, like, the nobody has explored yet, and that is the Alexis Guillermin full universe, like, movie making. And there's a part of me that's like, if you were a new filmmaker and you wanted to find an influence that hasn't been completely played out and absorbed by, you know, 100 people before you, you would totally want to go to Alexis Guillermin.
I mean, I think, you know, just as, like, a general rule for anyone getting into film, or not rule, advice maybe, like, what I found is just, you know, good practice is... take a filmmaker that you really love, or take a film that you really love, and don't necessarily copy it or copy the style, but try to understand what about it makes you work, and kind of get in tune with it and figure out what in that speaks to you and how to kind of reflect that voice back out, and, you know, find that part of you that it responds to and use that to create something. You know, I think that that's maybe a better approach than people trying to stylistically duplicate certain filmmakers. Like, there are filmmakers out there who are very good at kind of replicating somebody else's style, you know. It's there are filmmakers who can do Tarkovsky, you know, or can do, you know, some of these big name directors. They can emulate that style very precisely. They're good at it, and, you know, some of them get a lot of praise for it, but, you know, part of me finds it kind of like, you know, there's the style there, but something behind it's maybe missing, or, you know, there's not really something more substantial underneath. And, you know, with Alexis Guillermin, like, I think you can tell the style's coming from, like, a really hard-developed personal place. It's not coming out of thin air. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to do tracking shots because it's cool. Like, you know, it feel like there's a filmmaker with a philosophy behind him, and I think, you know, in being inspired by films and filmmakers, like, a part of it, you know, is sort of developing your own philosophy or ethos to kind of create things with. And, you know, I try to take that approach more than trying to copy somebody's style, or try to, you know, like, you know, oh, Tarkovsky used black and white and color, I'm going to do that. Like, you sort of have to kind of figure out what's meaningful to you and sort of, I don't know, forge your own perspective and just, you know, use that as a gateway to it. So I don't know, that's all a little bit vague, sorry. But so it's like, I wouldn't want to see a bunch of Alexis Guillermin clones, but I would want to see people inspired by these films who kind of create something that feels like, oh yeah, I can see the Alexis Guillermin influence, but it's its own thing, you know.
I don't know, man. I would kill to see some Alexis Guillermin clones. I would love to see some Alexis Guillermin fan fiction. So I texted you right after I saw Midsommar. Did you see that movie yet?
No, I haven't seen it yet. I'm behind all summer. I've been doing, like, I've been caught up in other stuff. But I was going to say, if you want to see, like, Alexis Guillermin film that you haven't seen before that's not quite as good, like, you should check out Alexis Guillermin Jr.'s earlier films, like The Last Train.
Nice.
Or what's the other one? Garpastum. But just watch those if you want, like, a little extra taste of what's going on visually. I don't think it'll work on you quite the same way that Krishjali Bekar does. Like, maybe save that for after you've seen some of this other stuff. But, like, Alexei Garman Jr., I think, kind of started off, you know, sort of emulating his father's style and, like, gradually developed his own voice. And I think his own voice is more conventional than his father's, but at least it's sort of authentic when you watch Dovlatov and Electric Clouds. Like, it feels like, okay, like, he's not trying to be his dad, and, you know, that's fine that he's just a more conventional filmmaker. Like, that's who he is. Like, I always think it's a little bit funny when you go back and forth between Melvin Van Peebles' films and Mario Van Peebles'. I don't know if you've seen any of them, like Story of a Three-Day Pass or Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, or have you seen Badass? Like, the film Mario Van Peebles made about his father making Badass?
Look,
Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, I mean.
No, this is a major blind spot. No. It's okay. It's a great, and I know right. What you're talking about, but it is a significant blind spot in my filmography.
You know, but if you ever get a chance to see Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song and then watch Badass after it, which is Mario Van Peebles making the film about his father making Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, it's really interesting to kind of see. First of all, like, Mario Van Peebles is he's a fine filmmaker, but he's, like, compared to his father, again, it's, like, very conventional kind of approach. And also, like, it's really interesting just to see, like, the ways in which, like, a son's perspective of the father kind of distorts what the film is. Like, you know, it looks like if you watch Badass, you would think, like, Mario Van Peebles' first thought when he decided he was going to play his father is, like, oh, I better hit the gym. Like, he's, like, jacked. And then you go back and watch, like, Sweetback's Badass Song, and Melvin Van Peebles is, like, kind of scrawny and, like, really intense looking, and, like, he doesn't look like a G.I. Joe, you know? But it's, like, you know, you sort of get that feeling that he must have been this sort of larger-than-life kind of giant figure for Mario Van Peebles, and to try to play that, like, I think in some ways he kind of, I don't know, like, there's some kind of weird diffraction in the perspective. But, like, you know, Alexei Garman, his father was also an important creative figure. He was author, and he wrote some screenplays for a couple of films. But his creative relationship with his father, I find, like, really interesting. It's not as at the forefront of Krishjali Bekar as it is with My Friend Ivan Lapshin, which is sort of based on his father's story, Lapshin, but it's, you know, you still sort of get the sense that there's, like, something very intense going on between the father and the son when you see Krishjali Bekar. Like, I don't know, if you hear Alexei Garman talk about his father's writing, he's like, you know, oh, I thought, like, he could actually sort of waste a lot of his stories. Like, he would spend, like, one day writing them, and then, you know, he would actually make a good story worse by not putting a lot of time into it or rushing it. And, you know, he has such a different creative approach, Alexei Garman, where, like, his films would take forever. And, you know, it's always interesting to see, like, the creative children of creative parents, you know, whether they're responding to them or looking up to them or trying to emulate them or try to do anything but emulate them and are influenced by them that way. Like, that's always kind of interesting to see. But
absolutely,
not every kid of a great filmmaker is going to be a great filmmaker, and sometimes you know, kid of a boring artist can be a great artist. I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. That's
I don't know how I got on this track, so I'm trying to desperately get off. Save me.
No, man. So I have to say, though, I look forward to hearing your thought. Midsommar is the first movie that I've seen where I thought, oh, either the DP or Ari Aster, like, has been watching some Alexei Garman movies. And that movie, obviously, a lot of people have talked. You don't have to see the movie to know that.
Right.
The Wicker Man and Ingmar Bergman are, like, name dropped frequently.
From the trailer.
Yeah,
I mean, it's basically. I saw the trailer for there's that new film coming out, The Lighthouse, with
Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson.
And, like, I don't, like, it's hard to tell from a trailer, you don't know, but, like, a little part of me was like, I bet he watched Hard to Be a God before he started working on that. Like, you know, something about these, like, big expressions when they're, like, you know, just in the trailer, like, I have no idea if the film's good or not or what it is, but when they're, like, crying and then hugging, and it's, you know, something about that looks a very, like, Alexei Garman influence to me, but you never know until you actually see it.
we can only hope, Martin. We can only hope, and if so, we'll come back here and talk about it on Film Baby Film. No, man, sure. this is great. So I think at this pace, you know, another year from now, and I'll finally see Ivan Lapshin, and I'll be rapturous all over again, and we'll have you on the show. We'll do the Alexei German like scheduling approach, and we will just stretch this just out over one a year. Decades.
Just make it last. Make it all last.
Martin, I mean, thank you so much for coming on and talk about this again. I want you to let everybody know.
Thank you for letting me talk about it. I could keep going. I'm sort of a, I'm easily distracted, but always happy to talk about this film. Thank you.
Well, so me too, and there's so much more to talk about. And yeah. The problem is that I'm in San Francisco visiting my brother and his 1-year-old daughter, and they're like hiding the baby right now as I've hijacked the kitchen for my little movie podcast. And literally my sister-in-law walked in as I'm talking about blowjobs and licking somebody's jacket buttons. And she's like, what the hell have I got myself into with this family? So no, man, this is wonderful. It's always, I mean, you were saying earlier about the reason why you write about Alexei German is because you just want to learn as much as possible, and you want to live, you don't want to assume his powers. That's not it, but it's more like you need to know more. It's that, but it's also because I do like the conversations a lot, and that's, I know why, that's a big part of why you do FlixWise Canada, is because you get to talk to other people who are just as passionate. Our little Alexei German sub-universe of the art, like, we are a subculture of a subculture, and we are right. Like, this guy, everybody, and people always say this, especially now. I mean, I don't know, is the world ever not totally messed up? But especially now, how can you not want to watch these two movies, Hard to Be a God and Krystalia F My Car, man? You know? We are right. Like, people need to see these movies, and there needs to be more podcast episodes about it, and they all need to have you on it.
I'll keep doing my part to inflict them on other people, I guess.
So if people want to find you, FlixWise Canada, obviously, and those great articles on Pink Smoke Doc. Is it pinksmoke.com?
Yeah, pinksmoke.com. I've got a new article. I wrote a piece about a classic Argentine film, Hijo de Hombre, which is pretty in-depth, and I talk a lot about Latin American cinema. That should be along shortly, I think, on the Pink Smoke. People can follow me on Twitter at Movie Kessler, and they can check out more of me over at FlixWise.com talking. I've got some episodes in the works, some exciting guests. There's one guest in particular I can say coming up. If you like Alexei German, if you like Krystalia F My Car, and maybe just Eastern European cinema in general, I think you'll be really, really happy with this guest. And
nice.
I guess that's it. Thank you again for having me on.
Of course. And obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you know about Film Baby Film, but do you know about the 25th Frame Media? Check out seriously, all the basically FlixWise and Wrong Reel are like the only podcasts I listen to that aren't on the 25th Frame Media.
How did that happen?
you have to listen to Wrong Reel, because that's like, those episodes, man, are always, I mean, they constantly remind me that I'm not a good podcaster. Like, it's hard being friends. It's hard being friends with James, because it's just like, all right, that's how it's supposed to be done. And then FlixWise, you guys,
James just like chows down on movies. Like, it's so good.
I don't even know how it's, I mean, honestly, I don't even, someone should do the math. Like, someone should do the math of how he manages. And then, obviously, you were the first person to ever ask me to come on and discuss Chris Marker, of all people.
Yeah.
Sans Soleil. So, and FlixWise is like the whole idea that you guys started with of going down the BFI Sight and Sound 250. And now Lady P is like
derailed.
You got derailed for good reason. Lady P is now Master P, soon to be Dr. P. I mean, it's so cool to just watch everybody, you know, flourish. It's, I'm so proud to be like a part of this little community. But yeah, you could check me out at 25thframemedia.com and subscribe to the master feed and get all the great podcasts. Or if you just want to listen to Film Baby Film, like, you can just subscribe to me, but really, like, broaden your horizons. And then, yeah, and I'm on Twitter, but kind of barely. Really, you should follow Martin. And you should follow Martin on Twitter. He's way more fun than I am. And Pinland Empire. But yeah, no. But so Film Baby Film. Martin, you're the man. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me.
Thank you.
25thframemedia.com. A listener-supported network celebrating film and culture worldwide.